Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992 here from our perch in 2023. I am one of your hosts, Phil Iscove.
I am your special guest host, Emily St. James, sitting in for your regular host, the ghost of Marla Hooch.
That's, oh wow, okay.
Listen, if you hosted this podcast with a ghost, I think that people would love that. So maybe absolutely. You should try to more do
that. It's dark, though. It's so yeah, dark.
It's great. With really us dark. Today... She's here. She's finally here, guys. Emily's better half, Libby Hill, is here to talk with us about, I mean, arguably the best film of 1992. Maybe arguably one of the best films
the greatest
of the 90s.
Film of all time.
It's a perfect movie. We're here. We're talking The Rockford Peaches. We're talking A League of Their Own. Libby, I feel like we did Steel Magnolias many moons ago.
Yes.
And... you know, this movie has a little bit of a Steel Magnolias vibe to it. And I only say that in the sense that, you know, it's a big cast of women bonding to some degree or another. But it has
a similar...
I thought
you meant, like, because I can quote every line.
Well, that might be true, too. But I do feel like, I mean, obviously these films are about 5 years apart or 3 years apart, whatever it is. And I'm just sort of like, they have a similar feel. And I'm wondering, is this young Libby?
Oh, yeah. This is like seminal Libby. This is, there are some like some foundational films in the Libby archives, and both Steel Magnolias and A League of Their Own are there. Like I would be hard pressed to identify others that join that are more influential,
in the ranks,
I think.
Sure.
God, I love Patter.
Sure.
I love beautiful statuesque women.
Obviously,
which I mean, didn't quite
wife,
understand
obviously.
At the time. Sure. But in retrospect, makes a lot of sense. I love the way women interact. I love women who generally care about each other and have enthusiasm at doing things together. And it's not just like girl stuff. A League of Their Own is mm-hmm. so special because I was raised in a sports family. Like that is the language. Okay. I have to have I have to keep track of sports to a vague degree. So I
baseball
can, you know,
specifically or all
no
sports?
No, no, just sort of all sports. Like that's the really frustrating thing. It was all sports growing up, and now my parents have settled just on like the university they went to. Like that's the only thing they care about, and that is such a like a woo.
They
winnowed it down so it's, much.
And like we went to South Dakota State University, and like that is so hard to watch in Los Angeles. You can't really follow it. It's you have to just kind of like.
So I'll be like, okay, so like the Twins. So it's, for example, we grew up as a Twins household. The Twins, for those that don't know, like made the playoffs, had their first playoff win in 18 years this year. I could not sit down and be like, so how about those Twins, to my dad, because like he's abandoned them, and I'm just like, then why I still care? I'm broken. Well, anyway, women playing sports, it's wild.
But I think this was what's interesting about the Steel Magnolias comparison to some degree is also the way that the group scenes are directed is very kind of messy and people kind of talking over each other, and yet such well-defined supporting characters. Like the bench, no pun intended, of this cast and how deep it goes and how much we feel like we know people based on a very short interaction earlier in the film is just spectacular. And it's that kind of plate spinning that I think both these films do incredibly well. It's even interesting too, because like watching it this time, I found myself kind of looking at the background players a little bit more and feeling as though they're all really cast well too. Like they all have really good faces. They all feel like they're a part of this. It's because I think in lesser hands, your stars would be popping out in the foreground and everybody else would kind of bleed. And yet it all kind of feels like a family. It's incredible. It really is.
I've seen this movie 4 or 5 times, which is a lot for me. I don't watch movies a lot.
Repeatedly. Yeah.
I don't watch movies repeatedly. It's just not my style. But I was watching this with Libby the other night for the show, and she was saying every line along with it. And I was like, what is this? Like, what's no, we rewatched Zodiac last night. Just for fun. Sure. And like that's like a comfort film for me. I've seen that 5 or 6 times, and I was watching that and I was like, I could get to a place where I could quote every line of this movie. That's a movie that's like the Emily sensibility is me being like an impression of Jake Gyllenhaal going, I've walked it. But but yeah,
does anyone have any nicknames for me?
Libby. But yeah, Libby was just like saying every line alongside everyone. And like, obviously I know like there's no crying in baseball, like they're really like famous lines, but yeah, I love this movie back in 93, whenever I first saw it, cause I saw it on video. And then I married someone who loves it even more. And like, so we saw it in theaters when it was at the Alamo, we've seen it, on video a few times. And it just, yeah, it is a great, great movie. And I'm kind of sad I didn't become obsessed with it to the degree that a lot of women my age did.
Well, and I got to be honest with you, I was really obsessed with it as well. This was a real staple for me too. I mean, I've seen it innumerable times. I knew most of the dialogue as I was watching it the other day. And I think I never saw it I've never seen it on the big screen, and I would love to someday because I'm sure it looks great. You know, I don't quite know why 12-year-old Phil had such a connection to this movie. I mean, as Emily knows, I'm a big softie, but I don't know what it was about it. It's my favorite baseball movie, even though there are great others that I love, you know, your Bull Durhams, your Moneyballs, what have you. But this movie has such a big heart. Like it's just so kind and sweet and funny, you know. Doing the research on the production of this film, it was not easy. It was a bumpy movie to say the least. It went through various sort of iterations and almost didn't get made on various occasions, which is insane to me. I'm also kind of amazed that this movie was a big hit. It's still the basically the most successful baseball movie for all intents and purposes. It made more than Field of Dreams and Bull Durham combined. And yet at the same time, it doesn't open number one at the box office. It opens number two to Batman Returns.
Does it ever hit number one?
I feel like next weekend.
Oh, does it the next weekend? Oh, next so it's weekend. One of the few that
yeah, okay, great. It had only like an 11 or 15% drop.
This is the thing, right? Where it's like you have to assume that the word of mouth on this movie is incredibly high. It comes out right in the middle of the summer, which is super smart. Like this movie is just like primed for all of this.
And great counter programming for Batman Returns. Yeah, like yeah. I've never seen Batman Returns. For as much as I grew up with a significant amount of brothers, which often will skew, you know, mm-hmm. what you see at the movies.
Sure.
We definitely saw League of Their Own in theaters. Sure. And my you brother too. Loved it. Like we would watch it on, when we had it on VHS, we would watch it and he would just like laugh. We would quote along with like John Lovitz, like the, get these wild animals away from me. Yeah, so like there was a commonality there, but then also like that's great counter programming. If you have kids that aren't interested or aren't old enough to go see Batman Returns, which was kind of where we were at in my in my household, like that's just it's you still get to go out to the movies and have a great time, and I think there was plenty of people who wanted to go out, you know, that weekend and see something that wasn't
absolutely
so dark.
You also like grew up with brothers, but of your many siblings, not a one of them was a nerd. Like you are the closest to a nerd, and you're so obviously a jock, as we all know. And like, but yeah, it was so like, you know, I think that, you know, a lot like when I showed you Burton's Batman 1989 in like, I don't know, 2009 or 2010. We made it halfway in and you were like, what the fuck is this? And then we shut it off. So like that was
never been a big Burton person. Let's just. Yeah.
That's fair.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I mean, it is true what you're saying that like 92, and we're obviously going to talk Batman Returns at some point. But this comic book movies weren't really a thing, right? Like it was still kind of nascent. And then on top of everything, as we'll discuss, Batman Returns is a weird ass movie that like almost went out of its way to thumb its nose at like anyone that didn't really, you know, dig it.
Well, you know, yes. We did see Dick Tracy in theaters as a
yes,
family.
Did.
Yes, so,
yeah.
So I don't know. Us, I don't actually know why we missed out on Batman. Probably because it didn't have enough McDonald's cross promotion. But
it had so much McDonald's cross promotion. I think it was because
what was it rated?
PG-13.
PG-13.
Dick Tracy was PG. And like, I think that one of the things that happened to Batman Returns is it very quickly got like, sort of painted with the brush up. This is way too weird and sexy for kids because Michelle Pfeiffer's performance in that is a walking fetish. And it's, she's
Michelle
so
Pfeiffer exists and was in the film.
She's so good in it. And her whole thing is just like it's sex personified. Like that's how she's playing that character, to be clear. I do think that it would have terrified and isolated you. And also you would have been like, no, I'm into that a little bit.
There's something interesting about this. I mean, I think ultimately, I think Emily's right. That movie got kind of tagged with the parent associations coming at it. And it sort of became this, don't take your kids to see this movie. Whereas The League of Their Own is... Although they do say shit a lot. I this time I was watching it being like, they swear a fair amount in this movie. Yeah. I'm not against it, but I was like, I was a little surprised. I guess I just didn't really realize it.
But there's like there's no sex. There's no violence. It's very much like if you're looking for a family friendly movie in summer of 92, it's kind of this. And sure. That's like, obviously there were other choices.
I don't know. There was some swing dancing and some tight dresses.
Ooh.
And Madonna was in it.
Sure. Madonna was in it. And Madonna is as pulled back as Madonna is in this movie. She is also walking sex in this movie.
I love it, though. Worth. She's so funny.
She's tremendous in this film. And it's amazing how, I mean, I wasn't paying attention to entertainment magazines or any of those sort of things as a kid. So I don't really have any sense of any of that stuff. But reading about her casting kind of being not an issue, but like Deborah Winger claims she left the movie because of Madonna. She said that, you know, she felt as though it was trivializing this and, you know, we were just going to, she took all of Madonna's baggage and kind of put it onto this movie. I don't think that, I mean, listen, I think Deborah Winger is a tremendous actor. That being said, it's a very different movie with Deborah Winger as Dottie Henson. A far less sort of popcorn movie, quite honestly. But the Madonna of it all, she doesn't, and this is probably to Penny Marshall's credit as well in terms of the writing, in terms of the editing and what have you, but like she doesn't swallow the movie. When she's in scene, she's great, but she's part of an ensemble. It never feels like the Madonna show, except for, you know, a dance sequence, which is great, and give Madonna all the dance sequences in the world. But it was interesting to watch it this time, thinking about post-Dick Tracy, everyone's favorite movie, a movie that we, the three of us, did see together in the theater relatively recently.
Listen, whenever we are done with 92, let's just do Podcast Like It's Dick Tracy.
Podcast Like It's Dick Tracy.
1 minute every week of Dick Tracy, and we just go deep.
I mean, it'd be the greatest podcast ever, quite honestly. Yeah,
and Libby has to be on it every week.
Every week to talk about the makeup because she loved the makeup.
What did I do?
what did you do to deserve this?
This is like when I had to go, when I have to go on every podcast to talk about Bicentennial Man.
You've only done it on one, but
that was an episode, guys. If you haven't listened to that episode,
this had Oscar buzz. Guys are so upset they can't do it because it got the makeup nom, and so now on their Patreon they're doing things that had only got one or two nominations but had way more buzz. And I'm like, listen, my wife loves Bicentennial Man. I would love to chat Bicentennial.
It's for such a bitch.
The thing about, so I was I watched the Blank Check Patreon episode on Fincher's music videos recently. Oh. So which was awesome. And there's obviously a bunch of Madonna videos in there. And I sort of was putting myself back into the headspace of like early 90s Madonna and the iconography of that. And this is such a smaller thing. Do you know what I mean? In terms of it's not her showcased in the same way that she had been. Which I think is interesting.
Here is when I knew this is there's a singular scene that proves that Penny Marshall knew exactly what she was doing casting mm-hmm. Madonna, and that honestly that Deborah Winger was wrong, and it's to the movie's benefit that she opted out. But yes. In the scene where they sing the song, mm-hmm. Madonna's not the one leading that song. Someone else mm-hmm. starts. Madonna jumps in. In harmony. Like, so you have one of the biggest music artists in the world, one of the most historically significant musical artists in the world, singing harmony. She's not the lead. She's not drawing attention because it doesn't really fit with her character. We haven't learned anything about the character having musical gifts or anything like that. We know she's a dancer, and we see that she's a dancer. And that's it. Penny Marshall knew that Madonna had more to give in this role than just being Madonna, and she did. She's spectacular and exactly, and like I legitimately cannot imagine anyone else in that role. I don't know. I think it was a visionary choice and an inspired. You have to have a real confidence to make a decision like that, and then to be like, I can do this. I can make this work, and she can work within this team in this ensemble. Well,
that's the key word in my opinion, which is that this movie is a team, right? Like it is not, despite the fact that yes, there are lead performances. Gina Davis is unquestionably the lead performance in the movie. At the same time, it does feel like everyone's working towards a common goal, and it really is an ensemble. I mean, Tom Hanks is you know billed first in this movie. He doesn't appear for 30 minutes. I think that it's just even in Tom Hanks's performance, maybe most Tom Hanks's performance feels as though he's a coach to a team and wants everybody kind of working towards a common goal. I think it's Madonna's probably best performance. She's great in Dick Tracy, obviously, but
she's really good in Evita. I will stand up for Madonna in Evita. That movie's a boring overlong thing, but yes. She's so good in it.
I think that this is her least Madonna.
Absolutely,
it's the easiest to forget that she's Madonna.
Yes, it's also, it needs to be said, this, so Dick Tracy comes out at 90. You've got Madonna Truth or Dare, which comes out in 91. She's also in Shadows and Fog in 92, but we'll forget about that.
I don't
for
even
a
know
second.
What that is.
It's the Woody Allen movie, the black and white Woody Allen German expressionist movie.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
They would just let him do whatever the fuck he wanted, huh?
They really, really did. She's in this, and then she's in Body of Evidence in 93, which is obviously a notoriously sexy movie. But it's worth noting, this movie comes out in July of 92. Erotica, the album, comes out in October of 92. And then the Sex Book comes out shortly thereafter. And it's interesting to me because in my brain, I thought that that League of Their Own was after Erotica and after all that stuff. And that it was closer to sort of the Bedtime Stories era of Madonna. And yet it wasn't. Like the song at the end of this movie, Which Rips, This Used to Be My Playground, is a great fucking song. And that feels like something that would be on the Bedtime Stories album, not... So it is interesting that this is wedged in there, and you just almost wish that she ran with this ball, no pun intended, than doing the sex stuff or whatever.
Right. I suppose it's difficult when your main when your main gig is kind of completely different than, you know, right? And she got so much, you know, shit for her acting, which isn't necessarily undeserved. Sure. Sure. I think she had a lot of talent, but clearly, I mean, it's sort of like Michael Jordan playing baseball, right? Like, you can still be better than 95% of people, but, you know, you're definitely not the greatest of all time.
No.
So,
yeah. I think she also, I mean, listen, Madonna is Madonna.
Yeah.
She was outspoken.
Yeah.
She was always a person that was going to kind of say how she felt about things.
Yeah.
But I don't know that she did herself a ton of favors when it came to this movie in particular. She apparently was quite a grump on set. She bitched and complained about Indiana the entire time. She's basically been barred from certain establishments in Indiana.
Listen, that's a rational response. I have spent a long amount of time in Indiana, and that is, yeah.
That, right, I mean, fair. That makes me feel better about her, honestly.
I want to stand up for sex, the concept. No, okay. I
thought you were going to stand up the for concept. Indiana, yeah. And I'm like, get the fuck out. But no. Sex, I will entertain.
I do think that, like, for, you know, for as much as I love her in this movie, for as much as I love her in other movies, sure. I do think that her willingness to tackle American prudery was like really a valuable thing. I remember in the 90s, like Madonna was like one of those people that like we talked about as though she was like the great Jezebel of the Book of Revelation. And to be clear, she was. But
you specifically in your like weird Christian sect.
Yeah, in my weird Christian. But like, and but she like would do a thing. You know, she would like be in a thing, and people would be like, well, that's Madonna. She's in a league of their own. How can we possibly watch that movie? It's going to be too sexy. And it was literally just like her acknowledging that sex existed and being forthright about it and being like willing to embrace her feminine, you know, attractive sexuality was like a really revolutionary thing. And like, yeah, I wish she had like submitted more often to like great directors. You know, I think about how often she worked with Fincher and how he like knew what to pull out of her. And like if she had worked with him on some film project, I feel like she would have revolted. She would have hated his process. But like she could have gotten a really amazing performance if she had submitted to more directors who had like strong visions like Warren Beatty, like Penny Marshall. But I do appreciate that she like took this ball of I'm gonna like make America okay with women being sexual, and obviously we are very okay with that. It's a thing that we now have no hang-ups about whatsoever, but like None. She did advance that, you know,
I don't mean to suggest that her trying to sort of shake up the puritanical establishment of this country is a bad thing, and certainly I'm all for body positivity and all the various things that she's,
I mean, when you have Madonna's body, it's easy to be positive about it.
I also just feel as though, and it's a product of the time that this all happened, right? I mean, she was trying to do this in 92, 93, right? Mm-hmm. Like, this is not the time. It would have been a hard time to break those ceilings. At the same time, I'm not sure that, like, the execution of it at the time was particularly great.
It's so forthright, and it's so in your face at a time when, like, you know, America was loosening up a bit from the 80s, you know.
Yes.
You know, we're in the Clinton era, but it's also the era of the religious right really coming into being. And like, I always forget this, but like, this period when she's kind of mired in controversy, and she then sort of tries to become a serious actress, and it doesn't quite work, and then she makes it's Ray of Light. And like, that is her big Grammy winner. It's like 5 years in my, when I was living it, experience it, it felt like it was like 25 decades. Years, yeah. You know?
100%. 100%. I do want to give a little bit of context on A League of Their Own, the movie that we're talking about today. As America's stock of athletic young men is depleted during World War II,
hell yeah,
a professional all-baseball league springs up in the Midwest, funded by publicity-hungry candy maker Walter Harvey, played by Gary Marshall. Competitive sisters Dottie Hinson, played by Gina Davis, and Kit Keller, played by Lori Petty, spar with each other. Scout Ernie Cappadino, played by John Lovitz, and grumpy has-been coach Jimmy Dugan, played by Tom Hanks, are on their way to fame. Madonna and Rosie O'Donnell co-star as two of the sisters' teammates. It's a very strange Google synopsis. A League of Their Own opened on July 1st, 1992, against Batman Returns, Boomerang, Sister Act, Unlawful Entry, and of course, The Mighty Ducks. It would go on to make $132 million on a $40 million budget. It has 81% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 84% from audiences. Far too low on both counts as far as I'm concerned.
I went and looked this up on Letterboxd and was surprised how many of my friends were like, 2.5-3 stars. And
that's just saying to me.
Fuck.
How are those people your friends?
Well, I have a lot of weird friends. Let's just come out with it right now. Sure. I'm gonna list some of the ones who are the weirdest.
As you should. Can we like, point
we'll put
to those
that on the wiki
accounts?
So people can always. No, I do have some theories both on why the three of us find this movie so rewatchable and why a lot of people don't, but we'll talk about that a little bit later.
I think
the screenplay of this movie is fucking weird, but it's great.
Yeah, we can talk about that. I do want to read a little bit of Roger Ebert's 3-star review, which I think kind of feels like the base of how people responded to the film. Until seeing Penny Marshall's League of Their Own, I had no idea that an organization named the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League ever flourished in this country. Even though I was 12 when it closed up shop and therefore an age to collect baseball cards and listen to the Cardinals on the radio, the league was formed in 1943 when it briefly appeared that the men's baseball would be a casualty of war. And once men came marching home in its marching home, it's a wonder the league survived until 1954. Then it was co-signed to oblivion. History is written by the victors. A League of Their Own follows many of the time-honored formulas of sports movies and a fair assortment of stock characters, the plain girl who gains confidence, the brash girl with the heart of gold, the jealous sisters. But it has another level that's a lot more interesting. This ambiguity about a woman's role is probably in the movie because it was directed by a woman, Penny Marshall. A man might have assumed that these women knew how all-important baseball was. Marshall shows her female characters in a tug of war between new images and old values. So that her movie is about transition, about how it felt as a woman suddenly to have new roles and freedom. The movie has a real bittersweet charm. The baseball sequences we've seen before, what's fresh are the personalities of the players, the gradual unfolding of their coach, and the way this early chapter of women's liberation fit into the hidebound traditions of professional baseball. By the end, when the women get together again for the reunion, it's touching the way they have to admit that, what do you know, they were real pioneers. There's a patronizing component to this review that feels like perhaps Raj. That was how critics embraced
it. Raj. Yeah. I think watching it this time, I thought a lot about the Demme movie Swing Shift, which I think is similar in a lot of ways, and also similar in that, like, his original cut, which is very hard to see, but I downloaded it illegally off the internet at one point, it's like, it is so much more just about what is it like to be a woman in a world where suddenly, like, you are thrust into, you can have a job, you can do all of these things, and society's expecting that of you. And then, of course, the studio was like, what if there was a romance in this? And that's what it became. And the theatrical cut is okay, but his cut is a masterpiece. And like,
did they just get together around that time? Am I crazy? Kurt Russell and Goldie were like,
I think
new couple around that time.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's, I was thinking about that. Like, there is this like kind of, there's a TV show called Homefront, which is also around these themes, which is very good. Starred a young Kyle Chandler, like super hot. Obviously Kyle Chandler's always been hot,
but still hot.
But like, there is this sort of unexplored, like, fertile ground for movies, because we keep going back to World War II because baby boomers can't get over their father issues. But like, there is this unexplored territory of women in World War II suddenly being thrust into leadership roles at home and in the military front. And you know, we don't really, like, this is like the best story about that, and it's kind of interesting that we haven't had more stories about it. You know what? It's really puzzling. We haven't had more stories about women produced in Hollywood.
It really is.
I don't know why that is.
What's interesting, though, and I hadn't thought about this until as you were talking, Emily, but like, you know, World War II opens up this corridor, if you will, right, for women all of a sudden to be a part of the workforce, to be a part of society in a way that they hadn't been previously. You have to ask yourself whether or not the feminist movement would have been as, you know, effective had World War II not happened, had there not been a foothold there.
It's fascinating because there's a similar thing that happens in World War I. Like, and at that point, the military was heavily segregated. It still wasn't World War II, but like, those walls were starting to break down. So you have this thing where women and people of color are entering the workforce in America in unprecedented degrees. And then the war ends, and there's a huge crackdown. There's this, like, people are thrown in jail for labor organizing. There's all this stuff that happens.
Okay.
Women are sort of forced back into the home. People of color are increasingly forced out of these jobs. But that's also the environment that gives us the amendment that gave women the right to vote. And it's also the environment that gave us prohibition, which is also driven by women, which is like a very, but it was driven by women because so many of them were like, you know, the victims of domestic violence at the hands of their husbands who were drunks. Just labeling the entire, like, men of 1920 drunks. There's a similar.
They did go to a great war.
Yeah.
I mean, to be fair,
he did come back broken.
Yeah. And then not allowed to talk about it whatsoever. The system may have had some flaws.
But there is a similar thing that happens in World War II, and the 50s are like a backlash to that. But it's also like, now the door's been opened too wide, because we've gone through this twice. And now we've got to go to this position of like, and the 60s, of course, is when the feminist movement really takes off. But it is this like weird, progression of history that A League of Their Own taps into. Sometimes in clumsy ways. We will talk about the scene.
No, I don't want to. I don't want to talk about that scene. Player. It just didn't exist.
I always forget it's in this movie because it's so bad.
It is. It's not good, but it's also interesting because some of the research that I did for this, we'll talk about this scene very briefly right now, Libby, because it's not a scene that I also particularly want to expound on. But there is an interview in BuzzFeed in 2017 when Lowell Ganz was asked about it. And his quote is, it did bother us that in order to be historically accurate about the League, we could not have a diverse cast. We came upon that scene as a way to make the point. A lot of people have commented on it over the years, and I'm very glad we included it in the film. I agree with him that there needed to be some sort of an acknowledgement.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's just the scene is a little bit hacky.
And also, I don't actually know a better way to have done it.
The solution the TV show comes up with is much better, but it's the kind of thing you can only do in a TV show, which is they have a parallel track about a black woman who cannot play in this league and is an amazing baseball player and is like trying to make her own way through various like amateur softball leagues and things like that. Mm-hmm. So, and also that show is much more forthright about queerness and like, but that is the kind of stuff you can't really do in a movie in 1992, you can't do the queerness, and like, yeah, you can't do a parallel story to Gina Davis's here without like tanking sort of the ensemble quality. So it is kind of like a thing you can only do in TV.
I totally agree with that. I want to talk about the cast a little bit. Specifically, I want to talk about Gina Davis for a second, because I feel like
for the
whole time. What I mean is, it's interesting. First of all, as we mentioned, the whole Deborah Winger of it all. But then there was also a Demi Moore part of this as well. So Demi Moore was going to be cast in the movie, and Penny Marshall said that she got pregnant. And basically, Penny Marshall is quoted in saying Bruce Willis literally screwed her out of the part. And which I think is kind of amazing. But I do think I can wrap my head around a Demi Moore version of this. I think she actually might have been great in it, quite honestly. But Gina Davis is so Dottie Henson. It's insane to me that anyone was ever considered, and that she was slotted into this weeks before production. It's incredible. First of all, everyone needed to know how to play baseball. So there were tryouts. There was a whole thing. I wish to be a fly on the wall for these tryouts to see all these actors trying to show that they can play baseball.
And the 3-month training camp.
Insane. Incredible.
I do think that like there is a thing about Gina Davis where they kind of cut around her baseball playing. So I think maybe she wasn't as adept as some of the others, but you see her and you buy that she's a gifted athlete. She's just like, she's tall, she's lithe, but she's like built in an interesting way. So you were just like, okay, this woman can obviously hit home runs every time she comes up to the plate. It's like a thing where even though she's maybe not as effective as some of the other women in the cast, like her just whole physique really works for her in this part.
But also as the catcher, we don't have to see her in movement in the outfield as much. And if she's always hitting home runs, she doesn't really have to leg it out on the bases either.
I feel like the perfect metaphor for what you're both talking about is, so Gina Davis can do the splits, but she can't slide into the splits. So there was someone that actually did the movement from behind of her going into the splits, and then there's the shot of her doing the splits. That to me is a perfect emblem of like what Gina Davis is bringing to the role, right? She could do the final thing perfectly, but like getting you to that spot, you might need someone to stand in.
And when she does the final thing, you're going to be like, this is one of the most beautiful women to have ever been on screen. And she's so charismatic and she's so like wonderful. And you're just like, look at her. Look at her.
Can I have a tight 15 minutes
please
on this? Like,
tight.
Seriously, this is me like condensing.
Is she your girl?
No, she is. I would go toe to toe with anyone and say that in this film, she is the most gorgeous individual to have ever been committed to film. She's like a stat. Like, she's like, this is why wars have been fought.
She's the Helen of Troy.
Yeah, basically. She's just, and then the fact that, okay, she's, God love Deborah Winger.
Sure.
God love Demi Moore. Gina Davis, because she is so like straight up Hollywood starlet, then to see her dirty in the dirt, squatting, dirt in the skirt. it is this encapsulation. It is this. And when I was a little girl, it was very much like, yeah, you can be everything. At the time, I didn't realize I couldn't be Gina Davis. And believe me, from that point on, I've had a lot of actually therapy and issues about how I couldn't. It's still a problem. But, It is this very fundamental idea that like you don't have to be one, you don't have to be another. And one of the reasons that A League of Their Own, it was so powerful for me in retrospect, is that I never felt, not because I was a jock, I'm a jock in spirit, but not in in actuality. But I never felt like a good woman, and like I never felt comfortable being a woman, and not in a gender identity way, but just in a, you know, there feels like an unspoken and a spoken idea of what women are supposed to be. And I never felt like I was doing it right, or I was mm-hmm. doing it well enough, or, you know, and so to have this movie at such a seminal time for me, because I was 11, was just like, here are all of these women, and like, in various, like, they look different. They're like, as beautiful as they all are styled, like, they aren't across the board all like beautiful women, but they're all women, and like that's the issue, right? Like, the struggles that they face are because they're women, no matter how traditional they are or not. Like, there's still a universality of womanhood. I don't know where I'm going with this. I'm very sorry. Please cut all of this out.
No.
Looking at this movie, I was like, you know, it is unafraid of saying here's these guys who find Rosie O'Donnell hot. And of course, reading into it now where we know she's very gay, it's kind of like, you're like, okay, sure. But like, it's unafraid to be like, Rosie O'Donnell is not built like Gina Davis, but these guys think she's hot. Madonna gets to be like, embrace a lot of the things about her that I would guess she was like maybe insecure about her appearance. You know, Gina Davis, of course, is Gina Davis. Lori Petty is like very different looking from like other. And like, I don't love how this movie makes fun of how Marla Hooch looks, but it's kind of always clear that it's in John Lovett's POV. And then she meets a guy and she gets married, and she's
the first one off the team married. Yeah.
Which is like, you know, I think that the Peaches would have swept the Bells if they had Marla Hooch and Dottie Hinson in the lineup, but Libby.
Something that clearly Libby continues to contest with, to struggle with. Yes.
Well, also they didn't have any fucking pitchers left.
Yeah. They traded away Kit.
They only had one.
They traded Kit, and Betty was gone.
This is a great
Betty Spaghetti
baseball movie, but they don't really, like, Penny Marshall doesn't really take us through the methodical lineup building like Moneyball, which I think is a real flaw.
Listen, they could have done that on the show in season two, and they just unfortunately were. So on the Gina Davis thing, just for what it's worth, Gina Davis, her first role is Tootsie, the totally unproblematic film Tootsie, which comes
out. No problems with that movie. I love that movie.
That movie is perfect. Perfect. Mm. No notes. She's in that. She's in Fletch. The Fly, I think, is when people first kind of take notice of her. She's obviously co-lead in that film. Great movie. Watch The Fly. It's awesome. Then she's in Beetlejuice.
I'm amazed you like The Fly. Like, I know that like it's a great movie. I'm like you so often have a reticence to movies that are kind of scary and gross. And that movie's very scary and gross.
But as you know, I'm doing my best to expand my horizons. I watched The Fly probably within the last 2 years, and The Fly is great.
And Cronenberg, of course, your fellow countryman. Canada for Cronenberg.
Exactly. Beetlejuice comes out in 88. She's got Beetlejuice and The Accidental Tourist both come out in the same year. She wins an Oscar for Accidental Tourist, a movie I've never seen. Should I watch The Accidental Tourist? Is it a good movie, guys?
I saw it when I was like in high school, and I remember liking it, but like, don't trust 15-year-old me. Yeah.
I will check it out. She's then in Thelma and Louise in 91.
Iconic.
A masterpiece.
Yeah.
Another perfect movie. She does back-to-back perfect movies with Thelma and Louise and A League of Their Own. She's in another movie called Hero, which also came out in 92, the Stephen Frears movie with Dustin Hoffman, which is sort of weird. I kind of remember seeing it in theaters with my mom and being a little flummoxed by it, but curious about it nonetheless. And then truthfully, she kind of has this moment, a pretty notorious moment. She marries Rennie Harlan. They make Cutthroat Island a disastrous movie, a movie that basically was like, don't ever make pirates movies until Pirates of the Caribbean makes everybody think we can all make pirate movies. But it's a huge disaster. It's incredibly expensive. She's the lead. He wants to make her an action hero. Long Kiss Goodnight comes out the next year. Again, Rennie Harlan trying to make her action hero. It doesn't happen. And then that's kind of the end of her feature career.
Long Kiss Goodnight's pretty good.
Like, I like Long Kiss Goodnight. I kind of like Cutthroat Island, quite frankly. I mean,
I've never seen that one.
Might like it, Emily. You like pirates.
I probably would. I probably would be like underrated masterpiece. Yeah.
I think you'd be like, guys, where were you? Why didn't you go to see Cutthroat Island?
I was looking up. So here's a movie that a horror movie I've never seen and probably will never see, even though I know I'd like it, is The Strangers. Like, I just like don't need that in my head when I go and stay in an Airbnb, which would happen. And then they made a sequel, of course, with my girl Bailey Madison. But they're making a trilogy,
correct?
Follow ups directed by Renny Harlin, and I'm just like, I thought he like was cryogenically frozen, but no, he's still around.
He's still around. He's still doing what he's doing. I mean, it is the Geena Davis run there of like mid to late 80s, early 90s is kind of unparalleled in my opinion in terms of the breadth of what she's capable of doing. I think it's interesting. I mean, this movie in particular kind of falls in her lap. She's a sort of a last minute thing, but to all of our, I mean, I think we all agree, like it's sort of insane that she wasn't the first choice.
She really should have been Lady Tom Hanks because she had that range.
The
action hero thing kind of got her on the wrong foot, but like you can see why they thought she could do that because Sigourney Weaver is like very similar, and like Sigourney Weaver is action hero and Charlize Theron too. Go ahead.
She also auditioned for Terminator for Sarah Connor.
That's interesting.
Yeah, which is obviously Linda Hamilton is iconic.
Yeah,
but
sure.
It doesn't not work.
Yeah.
No, for sure. I do think that Geena is, I don't think she's a bad action hero necessarily. As we mentioned, I don't think either of the Renny Harlin films, she's bad in them. But I will say that like she is almost too beautiful on a certain level.
I think that Americans want their action heroes to be a little bit unapproachable.
Yes.
Sigourney Weaver and Charlize Theron are a little bit out of this world. You feel like they don't quite exist. And Geena Davis, like her whole thing is, I'm like a mom, basically. I'm like a PTA mom.
Let me ask you both a question.
Mm-hmm.
Is part of Geena's push, the push to make Geena an action star, because we prefer our female action stars tall? Like, was that, did that feel like one of the only places she could go? She's 6 foot tall. It's 6 feet tall. It is difficult to, you know, there are some men in Hollywood who don't want to be paired with a woman who is taller than them. God forbid she wears heels. I mean, thinking about like I remember reading when I was in high school this movie Circle of Friends with Minnie Driver and Chris O'Donnell, and they built a trench for Minnie Driver to walk in when they had scenes walking, so she wasn't taller than Chris O'Donnell.
That's embarrassing.
And so I think about that a lot. So is it one of those things where, you know, part of it was out of necessity because she wasn't getting as many opportunities as let me check my work really quick.
Sure.
Meg Ryan's much taller than I expected. Meg Ryan's 5'8". I was like, I always think she's like a little pixie you can fit in your pocket. But no, she's 5'8". Yeah.
I do kind of think like 5'7", 5'8" is like the sweet spot for, you know, because like so many men who are very huge actors are like 5'9", 5'10". And so it's like this, I don't know. It's interesting.
I also wonder how many tall actresses round down in the same way that shorter actors round up.
Mm-hmm.
Not to prove that I know too much about Taylor Swift, but her listed height is 5'10 and a half. And like there's definitely like, oh, she's actually 6 foot is like this.
Yeah, she's definitely taller than that. It's interesting. I think everything you're saying makes total sense. I think that the Geena Davis thing is a little bit of Hollywood kind of not knowing what to do with her. And it's perhaps why she's put into these roles. I mean, Thelma and Louise being kind of a perfect example of that, of just sort of, you know, getting roles that other people might not get. I mean, A League of Their Own is another example of that, right? Where it's like people are sort of unsure, they don't know what to do, they're looking for someone to play this role, and she just slots into it perfectly. I also just feel like she can land a joke. She's really funny in this movie. she's also got this big heartedness to her, but she also could come across as like kind of a bitchy older sister that's like putting you in your place. She really just plays all of it. I mean, Emily and I, we talked about this a little bit, I think, at the end of the previous episode with Liz Hannah when we were teeing up this episode about the lack of Oscar nominations for this movie and how if this movie comes out today, it's, you know, it probably gets 13 Oscar nominations. But in 92, when this is the first film directed by a woman to gross more than $100 million at the box office, I think that people are just like, oh, it's a nice popcorn movie. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Penny Marshall Penny Marshall was also the second woman to direct a Best Picture nominee. It is
correct.
Like her, she's such a groundbreaking figure in American film that we have forgotten, I think, because her career petered out. Like her last few movies are dire. But yeah, like
I mean, her follow up to this is pretty dire, quick, right?
In this period when she makes big into awakenings into League of Their Own, you're like, well, this woman can kind of do anything.
I mean, she only directs 7 movies in her career. It's Jumpin' Jack Flash, Big Awakenings, A League of Their Own, Renaissance Man, The Preacher's Wife, Riding in Cars with Boys. I mean, that's the run. It's pretty crazy. And I, you know, Renaissance Man ultimately is sort of her undoing in a lot of ways. I mean, Tom Hanks talks about how she was the first choice for Forrest Gump. You know, that was, now I don't know what Penny Marshall's Forrest Gump looks like, guys, really hard to say. Not sure what that is, but I think that a lot of projects came to her after A League of Their Own. And I think it was a lot of passes or a lot of like, I don't know how to do this. And she just didn't follow it up. And it just kind of never really, you know,
I gotta say,
yes.
I don't fault any director. Forrest Gump obviously became a huge sensation. Any director for reading that script and being like, what the fuck is this?
100%. I wouldn't have read that. I mean, I'd be like, this seems like a tall order.
Well, you should have directed Forrest Gump. Like you were what, 13 at the time? You should have done.
I was 13 when they shot Forrest Gump. So yeah.
But I mean, familiar with like with the American burgeoning history. Digital effects and American history
absolutely.
At the time.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. It is interesting that she kind of never gets another shot. And it's, I don't know. I mean, listen, there's any number of reasons why, but this movie in particular, Gina Davis should have been nominated for an Academy Award for this role.
That category was fucking crazy. So weak that year.
Like, that's what I'm saying.
Like Hanks not getting nominated. He should have been, but supporting actors stronger, but there is David Paymer right there. And you're like, get rid of him. Put you're Tom like, Hanks in that category. It's perfect. But yeah,
no
actress was terrible that year. Like yes. Emma Thompson's in there and Mary McDonnell, and I like both of them a lot. And then it's just kind of like...
So the nominees, Emma Thompson, who wins for Howard's End, Catherine Deneuve for Indochine.
Which I've Mary never McDonnell, seen. Maybe I'd love it.
Maybe it's great. Mary McDonnell for Passion Fish. Great. Michelle Pfeiffer for Love Field, a movie I haven't seen, which I at some point will cover. Bad. And then Susan Sarandon for Lorenzo's Oil. I mean, again... You're telling me that Gina Davis shouldn't be in there?
And I do like Susan Sarandon again. And so it's like it, but also it's like I like Gina Davis better than everybody who's not Emma Thompson in that category.
Yeah,
Thompson, that's a towering performance. So like I'm not, but yeah,
in the best supporting actor nominees, of which Tom Hanks should have been nominated as well. But again, this is the moment before Tom Hanks becomes Tom Hanks. This is the movie that makes Tom Hanks Tom Hanks, for lack of a better way of putting it. It's Gene Hackman who wins for Unforgiven, Jay Davidson for The Crying Game, Jack Nicholson for A Few Good Men, Al Pacino for Glenn Ross, and as we mentioned, David Paymer for Mr. Saturday Night.
That
you
is
cannot
the
tell me
cut in the world.
I love David Paymer, don't get me wrong, but like, come on. On the Tom Hanks of it all, he's coming off of basically he couldn't get arrested, kind of. It's The Burbs, Turner and Hooch, Joe versus the Volcano, Bonfire of the Vanities. It is a string of movies
that I saw in theaters.
Joe versus the Volcano is a great movie.
Yeah.
I'll ride for Joe versus the Volcano.
I'll ride for Turner and Hooch. I don't give a shit.
I have a ton of nostalgia for Turner and Hooch.
It's fine. It's
not revisited.
Fine.
That was the first PG movie I ever saw.
Oh,
so you saw Coach get shot?
Yeah. Oh.
So this is why I think he had to really fight for this role. I think that you know, Petty Marshall really put him through his paces for the role. I think he really wanted it. He claims that it's still his favorite movie that he's made. He's so good in this movie. This shows, it shows every tool in his tool belt in this movie.
This is probably my favorite performance, but probably my favorite Hanks performance. Like, I think he is, I have trouble talking about it, but he's so good. And you forget he's Tom Hanks in it somehow. And he's just so much pathos. He's so funny. So funny. I can't imagine other people. I don't know how he simultaneously plays it so big and so small. I don't know.
He's incredible.
It's kind of
like crazy that my brain is like, well, his best performance is this or Captain Phillips. And it's like, that man has range, you know?
I mean, for sure. There was a moment that I forgot about that really hit me this time in the rewatch. And it's actually the last moment we have with Tom Hanks in the film. And it's, he's walking to the bus and so is Dottie. And he's like, that was Bob, huh? Nice guy. And she says, yeah. And he is heartbreakingly small in that moment. It is Jimmy at knowing he's not getting the girl. And it's a really heartbreaking moment. And I forgot that that's where we leave him. That is the last time we see him on screen. It really got me this time.
You like watching Tom Hanks fall in love. He with Meg Ryan, obviously perfect all the time.
Sure.
But like, there is a thing. You shut up, you. There is a thing where you kind of just want him to see him have respectful professional work relationships with women, and like he does that a fair number of times across his filmography. And like the only other example I can think of is Woody and Jessie the Cowgirl, which is maybe not like
the best example,
but like he did, like there are, you know, when the love story in Castaway, I think, is the weak element of Castaway. There's just a thing about Tom Hanks where you're like, well, I kind of think he's married to Meg Ryan, and like they live in a little house somewhere, and like he's just a dad somewhere. And like, I think one of the nice things about him and Gina Davis is it is like, there is this frisson of like, they are two people who are married to different people, different things, who just like have this connection. And it feels that way, both the actors and the roles. And like, I think I watched the scene where they kiss, which was cut wisely from the movie. And like, I see what they were going for, because she's like, what did you just do? I don't know. Please stop. And it's just like, it takes this thing too far.
It's a fucking grenade that they thankfully did not put in this movie. Like, I don't need it.
To speak to that scene, that final scene, a little bit, he's playing so many things. And so he's playing, obviously, his you know, kind of heartbreak that she's not coming back, his heartbreak that he's not going to get the girl. But I think what moves me the most in that is his heartbreak that he was not a better version of himself. That
yes,
he had all of the capabilities of being a man like Bob, of being someone worthy of respect, and maybe worthy of a woman like Dottie. And
he
made choices that
that
precluded that. And that's one of the hardest things to live with.
We never see him as a baseball player. Except that shot where it's like the thing in the Hall of Fame, Jimmy Dugan hits 58 home runs, and you see Tom Hanks in the uniform holding the bat, and you're like, he could have played Jimmy Dugan Origins, you know, like it would have worked. But
Jimmy Dugan Origins coming to Amazon Prime.
Listen,
that's AI for good, y'all.
Yeah.
But I think what you guys are both saying, I think, is really interesting, because it speaks to what I would argue is one of the enormous strengths of this movie, if not the biggest strength of this movie, which is the tension between the two of them that is not fulfilled, right? That we don't, that's why you can try to shoot that kiss any number of ways you want. I don't want to see the kiss. And withholding that from the audience is so vitally important to this film working for me that I think about their scenes together, you know, maybe the biggest one being the scene when they're on the bus talking about Bob and he goes for his flask and she gives him a Coke. And it's just, there is such a mutual respect for each other there. And obviously there is a connection and it's an emotional one. And whether or not it's a romantic one is kind of moot. Like their relationship works on so many levels that it almost does a disservice to it to make it just a romantic relationship.
There's a thing where in that last scene, yes, you can read it as he's never going to get to kiss her. But there's also this reading of like, oh, he's going to have a lot harder time winning the World Series without her. And like it works on both levels. Yes, and you're like, it is a professional and personal loss for him, which Absolutely. Is like, it's so great.
Yeah. And also, you know, just the idea that, you know, he'd found a kindred spirit, not necessarily in like a soulmate or a twin flame or whatever, but like.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Here's someone who made different choices from him. Here's someone who was the best, who walked away because she wanted something else. And that can be a tragedy, depending on how you look at it. But yeah, the thought that they could have been much more entwined in each other's lives, you know, if she had been a different version of herself. And I think there is I think he doesn't completely understand her. He doesn't completely understand how someone could walk away from it. But I also think that says a lot about the difference between men and women at that time too.
Sure.
She had never pictured being a professional baseball player because why would she? There was never any rubric for that. That was never an option. What she had spent her life doing was planning to stay in her hometown and marry the potential manager of the Dairy, because what else would she want? And it's so scary, and I speak this from experience, it's so scary to have that challenged, to be like, if you don't want this thing that you have defaulted to wanting because you never thought beyond it, then is that a failure somehow? Sure. You know, is it a failure to not get something that it turns out you didn't want? There is so much emotional complexity that I think this film understands that it never explicates, explains, it never expounds upon. I'm just going to keep pitching words.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, these are all good alts.
Yeah.
I think also, you know, I was thinking about this as I was watching it the other day in terms of the sort of the parallel arcs of Dottie and Jimmy, and how both of them are scared, for lack of a better way of putting it, of like challenging their notions of themselves and what society has projected onto them as well. You know, Dottie's whole thing about pushing baseball away, keeping it at arm's length, knowing she loves it, but not wanting to love it because she knows she can't have it, right? Like this idea of, you know, what the preconceived notion of being a woman in that time is, and this idea, and that's why it's sort of, it is kind of heartbreaking, Dottie's arc, in a lot of ways.
Oh,
in terms of the fact that, like, I mean, Kit gets to do, you know, Kit goes for it, right? Like, Kit decides to keep playing baseball. We don't really know what Kit's life is, but obviously she meets a man and has a bunch of kids and whatever. But I think that this sort of is one of the things that I love about the Dottie-Kit relationship, is that there's this fearlessness that Kit has because she's in the shadow of what she thinks is greatness. So she's just constantly just like throwing spaghetti against a wall and just going for it. And how much Dottie respects her for that. And, you know, the scene between the two of them at the end made me cry the other day when Kit's just like, when Dottie's like, of course I love you, you're my sister. And Kit being like, really? Like in disbelief that her own sister loves her and respects her. It's just, it's incredible stuff.
To return to my earlier thing about how a lot of, there are many people I follow on Letterboxd who are like, this movie's fine, but like no more than that.
Sure.
I do think there is a generational thing that is like, why is this movie about Dottie? Basically, she doesn't seem like, if you look at the screenplay of this movie, it is structured so strangely. The first act is about her relationship with Kit. The second act is about her relationship with Jimmy. And then like the team. The team is the thing that exists through the whole movie, which is why, you know, this movie is so powerful. The third act is about her relationship with her husband, who enters the movie very late, who's kind of not really a presence. And it resolves, but it resolves the other two arcs. And by that point, you've kind of forgotten this movie. It was about Dottie and Kit in a good way, in a way I think makes the movie more rewatchable, because she comes back and you're like, oh, right. This is like the big unresolved thing.
Yeah, the climax is them, yeah.
And it's like, but it is this like weird thing of like, I think if you're making this, honestly, when they made it for Amazon, like the leads were kind of basically, it was basically a movie about like the Kits of the world, the women who really wanted to play baseball.
Sure.
I think the strength of this movie is it's about a woman who kind of doesn't want this thing, but also kind of does, but can't acknowledge that within herself. And the main conflict is within herself. But like, I get why if you are watching this and you are like, have grown up in a world where like that kind of existence for women is like more shunted off. It happens all the time, obviously, but it's a not less like central to our pop culture. Like this is a very, this is a movie that grows out of, you know, the sitcom housewife trope in a lot of ways. And it's, I do think there is that thing where like, if you have not grown up in that world, like it feels a little bit strange that this movie isn't about Kit, because in most movies would be about Kit, or they would be about Jimmy, but this movie's about Dottie, and that's what's great about it. But like, you can feel the way that it could be about one of the other two.
I think, yeah, this movie has a protagonist who is trying to run away from being the protagonist. Mm-hmm. And I can see why that would not be interesting to some people, and I can see why it might be frustrating to some people to be like, see someone so gifted with such passion and so good at it who could just walk away from it. Cause we see that a lot in films, and it's usually so demonized, you know, how could you throw away your gift? And you know what? I'm really good at retail. I'm really good at customer service. Fucking hate doing customer service. This is a very stupid comparison. But like sometimes your gift sucks and you don't want to do it. I make a living as a writer somehow, and I don't necessarily enjoy writing. I talk to a lot of people who are just like who are writers who I like, really love it, but like
you're married to one of them, unfortunately.
Yeah, I'm not. I ran away from writing for a really long time, I'm like, nope. And then I realized it's the only thing, not only is it something I'm good at, but it's also the only thing I can do other than retail. But sometimes you don't want to be the thing that you are. Sometimes it's too hard. And sometimes
I get that,
you know, and so I find Dottie very compelling and beautiful. Obviously, when I was 11, I did not understand many of the feelings I was feeling, and now in retrospect understand much better.
I think that, I think what both of you are saying is really interesting. I agree with you, Emily, that like this movie being about Dottie is kind of weird, and the structure of it's weird. This, as I mentioned earlier, the production of this film was bumpy. They had a script. There's a story credit to two female writers. Lowell Ganz and Babalu Mandel are brought in punch it up.
Are the two female writers the documentarians who this movie... There's a documentary that this inspires. Oh, is that why
they have a story
movie.
Credit? I could have sworn that I read somewhere that they did a draft, but maybe I'm wrong.
Maybe they did it, but yeah, I think they might be.
I mean, I'm sure that the bulk of the work was done by Lowell Ganz and Babalu Mandel. They have the screenwriting credit, not a story credit, for what that's worth. But... you know, this was a very sort of improvisation heavy movie. You had Penny Marshall, who obviously comes from, you know, comedy background, wanting this to kind of have that patter that you were talking about earlier, Libby, of just sort of wanting everyone kind of talking over each other and lots of zingers. And Lowell Ganz and Babalu Mandel are very, very funny writers. So there's a lot of great jokes in this thing. There's a lot of jokes that are clearly done in ADR later, like over people's shoulders, or like, I got a good joke here that I want to throw in, like that kind of vibe. Penny Marshall also casts her daughter in one role. Tracy Reiner plays Betty Spaghetti, who's really good. And I'm kind of surprised didn't have a career, really. Like maybe just didn't want to be an actor. I don't know. But there's so many scenes with her in this movie, specifically the scene when she finds out that her husband has been killed overseas, that just breaks my fucking heart. And she is great in it. That's a hard scene to pull off. She's great. And then she goes to Gary Marshall, her brother, to play Walter Harvey at the last minute after they couldn't afford their original choice for the part, which was Christopher Walken. I think... Of course, Emily loves a chaos pick.
That would have been good.
Would it?
Yes.
Gary Marshall's great in this.
Gary Marshall is great. I want to just sing the praises of the men in this movie. When you think about A League of Their Own, you think about the men. But like, there's five men with major parts. There's Gary Marshall. There's Tom Hanks. There's John Lovitz. There's my boy, David Strathairn. And there's, who am I forgetting? Who's the other one I'm forgetting?
Bill Pullman.
Yes. Yeah. All of them perfectly understand what they're doing in this movie. None of them try to take it over. Even Tom Hanks, who has, you know, by far the second largest part after Gina Davis. Sure. And they're all just like perfectly there in service of the story, in service of the material, in service of Penny Marshall's vision. And like, totally. John Lovitz, so funny, but he like leaves the movie. They don't keep putting him in. Bill Pullman is just there to be Travis Kelce watching Taylor Swift. And like, I hope that joke still makes sense when this episode comes out. And I hope that their PR relationship,
by the way, I hope it doesn't.
I hope that their PR relationship sale. You know what? Just going to say this. I like was like, I'm all in on it now. I was before I was like, this is the what a weird like PR thing they're doing. And now I'm just like, yeah, they're gonna get married. They're gonna have two large headed sons. It's gonna be great.
I'm just here's my feelings. I'm just so thankful that a football player finally got the girl, guys. Because football players just, you know,
she hasn't had her dating an athlete arc, and I'm glad that we're having it right now. It feels it felt so inevitable.
I want to talk about the plot of this movie very briefly, but I want to kind of poke around it a little bit.
We have not actually talked
it's
about
it. Fine,
the
movie I don't care. Listen, if you're listening to this and you haven't seen A League of Their Own, like, who are you? But that being said, the actress who plays older Dottie, Lynn Cartwright, looks so much like an older version of Gina Davis. It's insane.
I think when I was young, I assumed it was Gina Davis. Yeah,
I did too.
And to the extent, so, when I was an adult and watched it for the first time, I still thought it. And I was like, wait, what?
So what's interesting, though, is Gina Davis dubs her dialogue. Which
well, that
I think
would be why.
Goes a long way towards tricking your brain into thinking that it's Gina Davis. But you almost don't. I don't know what Lynn Cartwright sounded like. She might not have sounded like Gina Davis at all. And they felt like, but she looks so much like her. It ultimately wouldn't matter, I think, but she's amazing. Here is a question for both of you. Do we need the bookends?
No,
absolutely not.
Okay.
They're fine. Like they're fine. I get, you know, I get the reason for doing them, especially like to drive home that this is like a true story. I think they could have handled it just as easily with like photos from the real league over the closing credits. But like it was very nice because a lot of the women in those scenes are people who really played. And it's nice to see them playing baseball. Sure. But yeah, I think you could have done just as well with the closing credits going over footage of that game or something. So
I never have liked the bookends, but I'll say that watching it this time, I don't know, maybe I was just more emotional, hard to say. But this time, I took less issue with it. Maybe because the first bookend actually kind of works. It's a nice way in. I like the interaction with the grandkids. I like the telling the younger one to kick the older one's ass now that she's sort of lowered the bar for him. I think that that dynamic works. What doesn't work for me as well on the flip side is that the bookend at the end is just really stilted because like a lot of these people just aren't actors. So you're just kind of like, I wish that I wasn't leaving the movie this way. So that's kind of how I feel about it. But I think that John Lovitz is fantastic. You mentioned that he's kind of barely in it, Emily. They cut back a lot of, he had a much larger role. Like his, and I think that, first of all, he's got a pretty substantive role to begin with. I mean, he's got a good like 10 or 15 minutes of screen time. I didn't need more of it. But they trimmed away basically all of his lines that weren't jokes. It's basically what happened. So what we're left with is just a guy who's just like zingers for 12 minutes, which is great. He's really funny.
He's like Iago the parrot.
That's a perfect analogy. Yeah, perfect. It really is. I mean, did you promise the Cavs you'd write? I mean, he's got so many jokes. The sir, your knee, do you like it? Like, there's just all these jokes that are just like kind of coming out of nowhere. I love the callback of the high ones, of the fact that Kit is always swinging at, which is a great metaphor, always swinging for balls that are out of her league, and that she finally hits one at the end is just like all this stuff that like I'm getting goosebumps, and I know it's super tropey stuff, but it all just works and hits on all the levels.
Are baseball and boxing the two movie sports because they have the best metaphors? Like you can,
it might be,
I like,
they might be
obviously like there's, I've always been like, I think it's because they come down to one-on-one matchups, but I do think there's something to like tennis doesn't work in movies. And it's because there's not a lot of great metaphors. Yeah. I think,
I don't think you're wrong. I mean, I think that sports movies work because they fit so well into a three act structure. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Just in terms of all of that. But I also think that the reason this movie works for me is that and maybe this is super obvious, but like the sport is feeding into the emotions, but the emotions are far more paramount. The character stuff is so much more important. So like, I got asked the question because I'm curious about what you guys think, but did Dottie drop the ball?
Oh, you're going to tear apart our marriage. Like,
I got asked the question. I'm sorry, Libby.
The other night we watched this movie and I have switched my allegiance over the years.
Oh, really?
In this. Yeah. And like,
okay.
The other night we watched this movie and we started to have a conversation. We started to have a conversation about it. And then when you've been married for a long time, you eventually are like, this is just not worth it. And I just was like, I'm not going to push this button because it's not. Well, okay. You know,
I'm not. No, Phil, it's fine. We can talk about it.
We
can talk.
No, our marriage is going to end.
But
right now.
But I do. I'll say where I'm coming from on this. Okay. And then we can unpack it from there. I never, ever, ever thought in all the years of watching this movie that she didn't drop the ball on purpose. Until recently, probably when I discussed it with Kenny and he adamantly disagreed with me. Did I even entertain the fact that she might have actually just been knocked over so, you know, by Kit so hard that she dropped the ball? Watching it this time, I stand by the fact that I think emotionally, I think she dropped the ball to give her sister the win. But I think it comes back to sort of what I was teeing up here, which is if you're a sports person, like Kenny Neibert is, you can't wrap your head around the idea of a person not putting sports first and not having that be the paramount thing. So for me, being a big softie, I look at this and think, she obviously gave her sister the win. She wanted her sister to have this moment. But I can logically also wrap my head around someone being of a sports mind and thinking, no, she just, you know, Kit wanted it more, which is what, you know, she does say to Kit later. But that's where I land on this. So it's kind of neither, kind of, that's my thoughts. Where are you guys on this? Because I'm sensing from your nodding, Libby, that you are more on the emotional wavelength of that she wanted her sister to have the win. Okay.
I am. And that's where I've always been. And yeah. I get really upset about it.
Sorry.
Because I think I'm probably wrong.
And you hate being wrong.
I hate being wrong. And
I feel what you're feeling.
I really respect that no one has ever, you know, clarified and Penny's gone. Gina Davis says she does know, but she'll never tell. which I could get that into conspiracy theories about that too. But I want to live in the Schrodinger's cat of it all. But I've always believed that she let go because she'd already let go of baseball. And here's the thing. This is my argument. And I don't want to even call it an argument because that feels like something I could lose. Here is my thought process. She went to the pitcher. She told them Kit's weak spot. She played the game and Kit beat her. Kit did the thing. Kit did the thing that she's never been able to do. She proved herself. And I think whether front of her mind or not, we'd seen Dottie take a hit before and hold on to that ball.
Yep.
We see her give Kit the explanation that
she wanted it more.
Yeah, that kind of covers it. I think she's upset afterwards because she hates herself for it. I think she feels guilty. I think she...
That's interesting. Yeah.
I mean, obviously, there's an argument to be made that she's upset because she got lost beat. You know, yeah. I could sit here and convincingly make the other side of the argument.
Absolutely. And your wife will do just that, is my assumption.
I know. And she'll use like directing, like, oh, well, the direction of the film says that, you know, obviously fart, 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 and your feelings don't matter.
That's going to be my new counter argument to Emily.
Your feelings.
Fart, fart, fart.
Yeah. Well, you're a snowflake. Oh, you know.
Snowflake. Yeah.
Yeah. And I get it. But somewhere inside of me, I'm still 11 years old. And I know.
I feel the same way.
What I know. Mm-hmm. And I don't really feel like challenging it. That's ultimately what it comes down to.
I get it.
Because I will say this, we can cut it out. But there is a sense of like, there are the Kenny Niberts of the world. And they're always, the sports people are always like, you're a fucking idiot if you think for a second that, you know, she wasn't beaten because she would never do that. And I'm just like, well, they're still humans.
Yeah.
And I get the arguments with like, she wouldn't do that to her team, but like, also she already left her team for like 6 games of a World Series. So like, I don't know that that's the best argument to make. Okay. Emily, go.
Marla Hooch should have come back. And just like, I mean, smashed some great slams.
If you're gonna blame someone for this,
yeah, seriously,
blame Betty Spaghetti's husband.
Yeah,
shouldn't have
died. Seriously. Let's blame Adolf Hitler.
Yeah, that's fair.
Rocker. And I do.
Yeah.
I am sort of like you, Phil. I saw this movie a couple times and never, ever, ever thought there was an alternate interpretation other than Dottie drops the ball on purpose, whether subconsciously or consciously. then I think it was like 2020, people were arguing about this movie on Twitter. And I remember there were people who were like, I cannot believe you think she dropped it on purpose. And yeah. I was like, oh, that's an interesting read of this film. I saw this again in theaters, was like, I still was mostly team she drops it on purpose. But here's the interesting thing. I have this weird thing in my brain that helped me a lot as a critic, because I never took notes, where I have like photographic recall of movies and TV shows. Like I remember shots. I remember like lines of dialogue. I don't have to like Libby's sit and take face notes.
Is incredible.
Just back me up on this, Libby.
Shut up.
It's been like, I wanted, like every so often I will remember something inaccurately. And I had remembered this movie inaccurately. I thought there was more direct ambiguity in the shot of her hand releasing the ball. I thought there was a moment of her holding the ball and then letting it go. And instead, it's very much a quicker, it rolls out of her hand.
Her hand hits the dirt and it rolls out.
Yeah, exactly. And like, I understand that this scene is ambiguous to some extent, but I do think the filmmaking of it is very much setting up. Kit came in and hit her so hard that she let the ball go. And I still probably think there's a subconscious element of her like, you know, being like, I'm done with baseball. My sister wants it more. I think that's in there somewhere. But I definitely think, to me, the emotional read that feels more fulfilling is that Kit just beat her. That she just like, I think it's a little bit cruel and condescending if Gina Davis lets her win. I think Kit beating her older sister is, and this is, to be clear, I'm the older sister. So like, I'm like reading this in terms of, yeah, I don't want to like, there is that thing of like, you know, how older Dottie talks to her grandsons, of that thing of like, you can't just like, you gotta be nice to your younger sibling, but you can't just let them, you can't just give something to them. And like emotionally now it's more effective to me if she is beaten by Kit. I'm not like diehard for this. I've held both positions in my life. I think there's a very, very solid emotional argument for she doesn't drop it on purpose.
I think that Libby and I fall probably pretty similarly in the sense that it's how I always assumed it played out. So it's kind of hard for my brain to kind of get on board with something. I'm also like, I can never get on a sporto headspace in terms of like, it's just not where my brain goes. I agree with what you're saying, Emily, that there is an emotionally satisfying version of that as well. I think that when push comes to shove, when everything is, no pun intended, when everything is said and done, what it comes down to for me is the look on Dottie's face as Kit is being lifted up by her team, right? Which is that the pride she has for her sister, the happiness that her sister gets this moment, a moment that her sister's been, you know, trying so hard to do for so long, to be out of the shadow of her sister, whether she, you know, whether it's intentional or not, I think that that's the end result is the same, which I think is important, which is that Dottie is happy for her sister.
Yeah, she's upset and she's happy. And I think that she plays, and I think that I think that that is true no matter what read you buy. And I think that's why the movie works. The ambiguity is in an action that ultimately doesn't matter to the resolution of the film, but it's also fun to argue about. I have so many younger sisters and I love them all dearly and I want them all to be happy. But if they think they're going to beat me at anything, they better fucking bring their best.
So I think
the Scrabble.
This also to me kind of speaks to, first of all, our hero, and I put that in quotation marks, but our protagonist loses, right? The end of this movie is not Dottie winning, it's Dottie losing. And on top of that, the team we've been following the entire time also losing. So that in and of itself is kind of crazy, right? That a movie does this and sort of zigs when we're expecting it to zag. I also think had they won, it wouldn't have been nearly as emotionally satisfying.
Do you know what movie this is just like?
I don't.
Bring It On.
Sure.
Bring It On is another movie that is about a character realizing that there's like a character giving her all and losing and finding like a real like satisfaction in losing, if that makes sense. It's another movie where there's no reason why the lead character is the lead character. You'd expect that to be Gabrielle Union or Eliza Dushku, and like Kirsten Dunst, she's phenomenal in it, but like the character of Torrance doesn't have a lot of like centrality to that narrative.
That's true.
Yeah, there is this interesting thing. I love a sports movie where the team loses at the end, so I think tend to be more iconic.
I agree. I mean, that's the Friday Night Lights model for all intents and purposes as well. You know, I mean, of just sort of the underdog team to some degree or another. But I, you know, one of the things that I love about the Kit and Dottie relationship is that as different as they are also both kind of on the same page. Like I think about the Marla tryout scene, right? Where Ernie's not going to give her a slot because of how she looks. And then they both put down their bags and say, fuck, like, what are you fucking doing? Like, are you kidding? Because she's not hot. I think that that's just a lovely kind of moment when you realize they're actually cut very much from the same cloth. They're not all that dissimilar.
The conflict comes from how similar they are.
Correct. I mean, the scene that also got me is the scene with Marla and her dad when she's saying goodbye. And he's like, you got to go where things happen. Just amazing. The dad who also plays a hitman in the previous film that we covered in Sneakers, which I think is amazing. But
Strathairn.
We're going to get to Strathairn. But I do feel like the tryouts are incredible. Hans Zimmer's score fucking rips.
Don't like the score. That's the one thing about this movie I don't like. The main theme's fine. I think it is Hans Zimmer trying to be Randy Newman, and it doesn't quite work for me.
Oh my God. I could not disagree with you more. I think when he's killing it over these montages and you've got the fucking trumpets and the just like, I'm ready to run into the street screaming for the Rockford Peaches. I don't know what you're talking about. But the Kit trying out, getting on the team, again, the callback to that and saying like, thank you for getting, she's like, I just got you on the train. It's just like, again, these are the moments where you're just like that central relationship of, I don't have any siblings, but I think this is one of the best sisters movies, just in terms of really, you don't think it's a good sister movie, Libby?
No, I do. I wanted to add a moment, which is, you know, they're at home and Kitz makes her plea and she's like, I can't stay here. There's nothing for me here. And she's right. Like she'd die there. It's one thing for Dottie to have, you know, her life laid out for her, but Kit needs more. And like, so at the end.
Yes, sure.
It doesn't matter why Dottie, what happens, because symbolically, Dottie's letting go of this life. She's letting go of all of that. That's ultimately what Dottie's letting go of, regardless of whether she's letting go of the ball or not. But also, I think the Peaches lose, and it's important for the Peaches lose because the league loses. You know, it temporarily lasts, but it's temporary, and it isn't necessarily a happy ending. Like, yes, there's some progress, but you know, women's sports still aren't seen at the same level. It's good, it's right that it's bittersweet. I think, and probably it's the right call to have the bumper at the end, to see,
as you're saying,
how they all like are very happy with how special it was.
Yeah, the victories.
But
I agree with that. It's you know, this movie is filled with a lot of sort of, in lesser hands, treacly moments, right? I think about Shirley not being able to read and being able to see her name on the tryout lists roster. Or what have you. The roster. In lesser hands, that scene would have been brutal, but I do think that Penny Marshall has a very light touch about the stuff you're talking about. So the ending, as disappointing as it is, I think she finds a way to navigate that so it doesn't feel that way. Yeah. It feels like a win. And part of that is because we love Kit and we're happy for Kit. And that goes a long way. You know, as I mentioned earlier, Tom Hanks doesn't come into this movie until 30 minutes into the film, where he's shielding his eyes because he's got a hangover from the sun. And he's got an amazing scene with Gary Marshall where just a great scene of expositional dialogue. As we both know, or all three of us know, writing expositional dialogue sucks. And love having it. To backfill information sucks. And to make it funny, and to make it sing, and to have three pages of these two guys.
And I've never thought of it as expositional. Obviously, yeah. That is what it is. Obviously, and it's really the only way to get Tom Hanks in the film. But like, they're so good. It's so deft. And maybe I'm bad at my job for this reason, but like, I just never thought about it that way, because it's so entertaining, and because I just am desperate to know more. Like the second they say anything, like, I'm like, oh my God, what is this history? Tell me everything.
Yeah. It's like, how did this happen? When he's I would have written you a thank you letter, but they wouldn't let me to have anything sharp to write with. And you're just like, what is happening?
In my defense, there is the hood. There was a fire. He's like, you set that fire. everything is just it's set up punchline, and God, I fucking love this movie. It's exquisite. Great.
Jimmy showing up drunk on the first day, the pee take, which, by the way, Penny Marshall was off camera. She had the hose. So no one knew when he was going to be done peeing, not even Tom Hanks. So she's just like keeping it going as long as she wants, which I think is fantastic. Him tearing up Betty's husband's baseball card, where I'm just like, like, poor Betty. It's really amazing. But to go to what you were talking about earlier, Emily, on a script level, like, if we sat down and took the beats and like boarded out this script, you'd just be like, wait, what now? Like, now we're going to poison Miss Cuthbert. We're going to go to a bar. We're going to have a dance scene. We're not obviously great at that dance scene. You're going to have a kid hitting on Dottie that gives her a lift. You're going to it feels like a comedy, right? Where it's kind of banging around from plot point to plot point. And yet it works. I don't know. It shouldn't.
It's very episodic. And I think that you can get away with that in a baseball movie because of how baseball's structured. Sure. I as we're sort of heading toward the conclusion, I have no memory of where we are in this movie, because I think there's like a, especially in the sisters thing, there's like a subtextual queer quality to this movie. It's a little bit.
I think she's a little coded. Yeah,
but she's like, no, obviously she comes back and she has like 17 children. So you're like, okay, well,
just so you didn't get the wrong idea about Kit. Here's all of her progeny.
Is that a Lori Petty thing a little bit, though? Like, I think about her in Point Break the year previous, right? And like, that movie's playing to some degree with androgyny or gender roles.
Well, yeah, Lori Petty always kind of feels like she's like starring in a much queerer version of whatever movie you're watching.
Yes, I agree.
And like that includes like Station 11. there is this like thing where a lot of the characters are kind of queer coded, and it's you know, obviously it's 1992, so they can't be overt about it, and they have to reassure you at the end that they all got married to boys. But like, you know, the Amazon series draws on the actual memories of the players in this league who were like, oh, yeah, we were having sex all the time. And it's like, awesome. But it is there. I do like the way that it portrays Kit needs to get out of there, because the only way she can be herself is to go somewhere again where things happen. And it's a tremendously queer character arc there. And Dottie being like, I support you, but I can't live that life, is also like a very like, obviously she's extremely cishet coded, not coded at all, but like it is, you know, it is that fundamental experience sometimes of like having a queer sibling and not, you know, loving them, but also being like, my life, I fit so much better in this other world. So
I hear that for sure. I think that this is a very straight movie, right? Like the way that this movie handles sex is essentially Madonna, right? Mm-hmm. Like Madonna's teaching Shirley how to read by reading erotica, which is a great scene. You know, Madonna making out with boys or men at the bar, like that is the sort of rompy kind of playful way that it deals with sex. But I want to talk about David Strathairn, Mr. Lowenstein, for a quick second here, because I know Emily we can't wrap this up without talking about your man.
Here's the thing. Emily isn't the person in this household who loves David Strathairn the most. That's just like
I just think he's
super hot. I didn't know this. Yeah. I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, okay.
Please, go for it.
So David Strathairn, who plays Mr. Lowenstein, which is essentially sort of Gary Marshall's number two, who's sort of running the league. There's this moment probably two-thirds of the way through the film when the league isn't doing particularly well and it looks like it's going to get shut down. And he says to the team, like, you know, really be special today. We've got a photographer for Life magazine, whatever. Madonna, who's given a really great moment, nails her speech where she's just like, you're not fucking shutting me down. Like I'm not going back to having some fucking guy sweating gin on me or whatever. Like she gives a great speech and Strathairn is perfectly cast in this role as a guy who you feel wants to do the right thing. The big sort of speech he gives Gary Marshall near the end of the film where he's like, you're really going to shut this shit down. Like we just told these women to get out of the kitchen to serve their country. And now we're going to tell them to get back in the kitchen. He is so good in this movie in a not showy role.
He's an ally. Let's just say it.
He is an ally. Yeah. Ira Lowenstein, ally.
The only thing that would have made it better is if throughout this entire movie he was wearing a trucker cap that said Trout on it. Like that would be.
That's a shout out to Passion Fish for our listeners.
Yeah. I mean, they listened to the Passion Fish episode with great because they obviously have Passion Fish fever. So.
Great movie, by the way. So yeah, I mean, listen, there's a bunch of stuff that happens, but we've got sort of this Marla leaves, Dottie protecting the plate, as we mentioned earlier, perhaps setting the stage for something near the end of the film.
It inarguably sets the stage for something.
Yes.
It's just
yes.
like you either believe it sets the stage yes. for her absolutely. Giving Kit yes. the win or for showing how much Kit has improved by getting out from under her sister's shadow.
I want to talk for just a quick second about, so Kit is traded. Okay. So we have this moment where Dottie's like, devastated. I want fucking out of this. Lowenstein's like, okay, we'll do a trade. I'll figure it out. And then Kit gets traded to the Racine Belles and Kit and her get in this big fight. I understand Kit's frustrations. But Kit thinking that Dottie has some Machiavellian plan here to like somehow destroy her fucking baseball career is ridiculous.
Well, you don't have siblings.
Yeah, that's so clear. You don't have siblings. Like you never said anything. Like, I mean, Kit has always blamed Dottie. Like that's just what she, you know, because she's wasn't as good as Dottie. Like I have a beautiful sister and it's her fault. You know, I joke it, but like, you know, yeah,
sure,
you and your sister have such Dottie Kit energy. I love
know.
That.
Well, there's like, she's like 10 years older than me. So it's, you know, but yeah, it's just, she has to, Kit's angry at herself. She's angry at the situation. She's angry at Dottie because it's always been safe to lash out at Dottie because mm-hmm. Dottie's always going to love her, whether Kit realizes that. But like,
yeah.
you don't lash out at someone like that if it isn't safe to lash out at them. I think especially for women yeah. in this period of time.
I hear that. I think it's, and just to be clear, I'm not suggesting that her irrational behavior isn't justified. It's just
she's
every
crazy.
Time I listen to this fight, I'm just, and Dottie goes in and says, blow it out your rear end, Kit. I'm like, yes, blow it out your rear end, Kit.
Do it.
You're making no fucking sense.
Yes.
And then when obviously at the end of the scene, where she's like, oh, piss on your head, on your hat. It's fucking crazy.
Has anyone seen my new red hat?
She's incredible. That actress who she was on Mad About You. Am I crazy that she was on that show? I'm trying to remember like why I know that actress, because I know she's been in other stuff, but she's so good in this movie as like this just in another world person, this person who's just like completely living in her own little it's just incredible. Even at the end, like at the very end, when the stand-in catcher for Dottie is like, you say that because you don't have to go to Saskatchewan for the next 5 months, and she's like, well, you said it was really lovely. Like, there is something about the way that she sees this world, this very idyllic perspective. The scene where Betty finds out that George has died overseas is a great scene because of how it's blocked and how it's directed. The way that Tom Hanks is walking down this hall, or down the locker room, and people not knowing who he's going to land on. And then the moment that it becomes clear that it's Dottie or Betty, and Betty shoots her a very quick look, like this moment of just like an acknowledgement that like it's us against the world, and like almost a hopefulness that it's Dottie and not her, is tremendous.
And like an apology.
Yes, yes.
For that
yes.
betrayal of like,
yes,
I'm sorry that all I want right now is for your husband to be dead. You know,
it's and it's wordless. Like, this is again a testament to all the actors in this scene, everyone around them, right? Like the people that are just, you know, witness to this thing, and the, for this, it to yes,
yeah, right. Sorry, go ahead. But like, yeah, like what gets me every time is the person, as soon as Hanks is clear of them, who sprints out for Miss Cuthbert.
Yes.
Hanks opening it and like knowing
yes
immediately, which is testament to how much he's changed from the beginning of his coaching. It's
him hugging her.
Yeah.
Like, again, this is a testament, not just to a testament to everybody, that Tom Hanks's gradual from the guy who was scratching his balls for an hour to a guy who is now hugging Betty Spaghetti.
Anything worth doing is worth doing right. Well,
I can certainly use the money. I mean, it's just it's just good shit. But that arc is just perfect. It's just wonderful.
And the fact that it kind of comes out of nowhere, because that's fitting. Because that's because it did. Because
yeah.
It does, because
it's really, really good. It's heartfelt. And I also think that part of the reason this scene works so well is that it's teed up with the callousness of the shitty fucking soldier who doesn't even want to give the telegram because he doesn't know who, blah, blah, blah. Like, you need that callousness, and to see Tom Hanks push, you know, like that allows us into the scene in such a beautiful way.
And like his anger, yes. And like the like showing that he's still like, he's still Jimmy Dugan. He still has yes. that temper. He still has very little patience for people's foolishness. Yes. I'm sorry. I keep interrupting. I just love this movie. Not, so fucking
don't,
much.
Don't, I mean, that's the truth. It's just, I really do think that this movie is a masterclass in a lot of ways. But I think that the thing that I really took away, and this underscores what you were saying, Emily, is that if I put this script under a microscope, it kind of doesn't make a ton of sense, right? Like, it's bumpy. And it's a testament to, or a masterclass of casting and directing and tone, that you can take a script that might not be seamless and turn it into, in my opinion, a seamless movie. Like, intent and knowing, like, Penny Marshall just knowing what the tone was and what the dials were so perfectly.
I also think there's no genre of film that can afford bumpiness more than a sports movie. There's sure. a like the arc is always clear. The season is always going to one place. And, you know, a sports movie can be a lot worse than this and still be very good.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of what we were talking about earlier, of like the bones and the DNA of the quote unquote sports movie are so solid. Like, those flags are planted so deep that I think an audience is going to kind of go on a ride with almost any of them. Right. Like, I mean, I say that there are obviously a lot of bad sports movies, but like, but most of those would have a rousing, happy ending in a way that this film. Everyone's favorite draft day. But yeah, I mean, listen, I could obviously talk about this for a million years, but I feel like we've talked about it for a long time.
Bill, you should write a sports movie. It should be called Hockey Friends.
Listen, I would write Hockey Friends.
Project is?
Yeah. I would write Hockey Friends. Yeah, that's the new project.
I'm so excited.
Yeah, hockey probably is the sport that has the least amount of successful movies. We've covered one of them. Mighty Ducks, obviously.
Miracle is pissed.
Miracle's very good.
Slapshot.
But
fun.
I hate it because
I mean
Team
it's
America
a lot of
can
I mean trauma.
USA.
Trauma.
USA.
I get it.
We
get
beat
it,
the USSR, Phil. Canada had you nothing did. To do with it.
We had nothing to do with it. I agree with that. That's true. You did. You beat communism through hockey.
We beat communism. Yeah. And everything I mean, was good after that.
Miracle's good. Slapshot's anyway. Good. And you know what? Mystery Alaska's not terrible, guys.
Hockey Friends is. Coming to a theater near you, written and directed anyway, by Phyllis Koh.
Let's rate this movie. I have a feeling that I know where Libby will land. I know where I land. It's 99s across the board, guys. This movie is had I have literally no notes. I can't be rational about this. The last time I was probably this irrational was probably When Harry Met Sally, another movie that I think kind of unimpeachable in my humble opinion. It is so in my DNA. I've seen it so many times that I can't even. So that's where I'm at. Where are you at, Emily?
92 for 92. I got some small quibbles.
That's good.
I love this movie. It has grown in my esteem over the years.
Sure.
I really liked it when I was a kid, and now I unabashedly love it.
As your estrogen levels have?
As my estrogen levels have increased. I got it for the queer phobia scale. I'm gonna give it my standard 3, which is just like there's no overt queer phobia, but you can tell a lot of these people like don't like homosexuals.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
there's a lot of cool subtext that I think makes this movie really sing if you read it through a queer lens. And honestly, if the TV series had never existed, I might be a little bit more charitable, but the TV series is so much more like Darcy Carden and Abby Jacobson have like a thing in that. It's good. It's hot.
They do. That the show, you know, I don't want to say I feel bad for the show because that feels, you know, patronizing. Just such a high bar for me that I was just like, I understand why you want to try to do this. And it's a noble goal. But I couldn't get into it because I love the movie so much.
I had in my brain the original TV series from the mid-90s
CBS.
Which I watched a couple episodes of for an AV Club article. And that is so bad. So I was like, well, this is better than that. It's not as good as the movie, to be clear. But like, it is a worthy thing.
Do you think, I mean, hindsight, and I don't even know if you could get it made without the League of Their Own tag, but like, would it have been better? Would it have opened it up more if they didn't have that hanging over them? If they were just like, let's make a, you know, there was this women's baseball league. I think that's a really a fertile ground for, and you could sort of distance yourself a little bit from the iconography of,
well, because the comparisons would be there no matter what, right?
Right,
like I'm sure people would be like, oh, this is whatever, but better to just I agree with you, just not have the title.
Yeah.
I understand also that we live in this IP saturated universe and that it's incredibly hard to get things made, but all that being said, I'm glad it exists. I certainly didn't hate it, but I also found myself just not being able to lock into it in the way that I wanted to because of the title. But where are you, Libby? We didn't get your rating. Are you just 99?
I think it's, I mean, it's one of those that I own. It feels like anymore, I only come on the show for movies I love. So it's kind of moot for me to rate these, but I'd say 99. Like the ending, I am unable to be rational about this film.
Sure.
I just, I mean, have me back on for Zodiac.
Great.
It's just part of me. It is so fundamental in like who I am and why I am the way I am that there's no way for me to be impartial or rational about it. So
I think that,
full marks.
You know, Kenny and I had a similar, I think it's an age thing too, right?
Yeah.
Which is that, you know, Kenny and I, when we did our 89 series, these were movies we saw so young that they imprinted on us, and we saw them so many times, And as Emily can attest, with this miniseries, there have been a handful of those types of movies for me where, like, I kind of can't separate the amount of times I watch it on VHS at like 2 in the morning. You know, it doesn't make sense to a woman a good movie, but it's a movie I saw a million times. You know, so it is just one of those kind of things. But so next week, we are covering the aforementioned film you've never seen, Libby, which is Batman Returns, with TBD guest. We'll figure that out when we figure that out.
Libby, but, do you want to come on for Batman Returns?
I mean, if you really would, can't find anyone, I honestly,
you sort of alluded to this, Emily, would love to get Libby's take on, you know, Selina Kyle and Catwoman, because, like, I think you'd have a pretty hot take, but I mean, I also think
Michelle Pfeiffer is a hot take.
Right. I don't know that you would like anything else about the movie.
Here's the thing is, like, I have a very difficult time actually with overt sexuality. So I would probably just be so uncomfortable, and I would just sit there on the podcast and be like,
listen, Libby.
Well, because it's a very horny penguin too.
Yeah. Michelle Pfeiffer's hot. Penguin's hot. That's
you guys know how much I like elaborate makeup.
You don't want to hear Danny DeVito say overly horny lines while green drool comes out of his mouth.
Genuinely, I know my wife very well, strangely, and this I think Batman Returns would be just a nightmare movie for her. Like, I think that she would what would happen is she would be like, okay, so 0 to 99, what are you gonna do? And Libby would be like, I respect the craft in this movie, I get why you like it, but Jesus Christ. And she gave it like a 36. So
Here's the other thing too. As you mentioned, you're not a Tim Burton guy, you're not a Tim Burton girl.
I'm not a Tim Burton guy. It's whatever.
This is maybe the most Tim Burton movie in terms of him just having free reign to do whatever the fuck he wants.
Oh, so it's Jesus just
like
Christ.
It's just really the most Tim Burton.
Anyway, more than fucking Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
100%.
Oh my God.
Because it's also he's like gloomy and he's sad at this point. I love this movie unabashedly.
I like Batman Returns more than I know my wife would. I can't get there with you because, again, it's the Tim Burton thing. I just find him very...
I get it. We're going to unpack all of that. We have a string of Christmas movies coming out over the end of December. Batman Returns, Muppet Christmas Carol, Home Alone 2, everyone's favorite Christmas movie.
That's triggering.
It's Emily's time of year. So, you know, it's Christmas.
Ding dong, ding dong, do, 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 do.
Can I just say that was a little bit harrowing the way you were? It almost seemed like a horror movie.
Hold on.
Yes.
Are you two doing the remake? Oh no, it's a TV movie.
There's a TV movie
of Christmas in Connecticut from 1992.
No, we're not doing that.
Starring Diane Cannon and Kris Kristofferson. But do you know who is directed by?
Who?
I have no idea.
Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Okay, we're doing it.
Wait. Do you know when it came out?
When? Christmas Day.
April 13th.
What's great about that is that means it was Friday the 13th. I mean, Christmas in Connecticut.
A TV movie. They might have put it on Sunday.
They might have put it on. Yeah, they might. I mean, listen, Emily, I'm excited to get into Christmas with you, and to go whole hog.
We're gonna go on a journey together into just like, but we're we're not just doing Christmas movies, right?
No. Okay, December is, for what it's worth, just for our listeners, doesn't really matter. But December is The Bodyguard, Sneakers, A League of Their Own, Batman Returns, Muppet Christmas Carol, and Home Alone 2.
Libby fucking loves The Bodyguard. So,
do you love
that in theaters?
Did you really? I'm very curious.
It in like 30 years.
Have you seen it, Emily?
No, I have seen it. I didn't see it in theaters, but like I don't remember
curious
it at all.
I have not watched it in a very, very long time. I'm excited to watch it. I'm excited to unpack it with your friends, Emily.
My best pals.
Coming on to talk about it. Yes. Yeah,
cool.
It's going to be great. Libby, you're the best. Obviously, I love you.
No. Yeah. I love you too. Thank you. Like, I and like,
I mean,
I love being on the podcast when it's movies I love. Let's keep this trend
we're
going.
This is the thing. I've realized that you're happier when you come on for movies that you like. And I just like it when you're happy, Libby. So,
thanks,
like,
Phil. I do too.
I mean, that's why Cool World was not a movie that I thought you should come on for. For our listeners, I legitimately got a phone call from Libby after Cool World saying, why are you doing this to me and my home? And listen, that's a justified. It's fair.
Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah.
Was that like the, yeah, because that was, I mean, obviously that was when we had a newborn.
Yeah.
It definitely set the bar low. I was like, well, most things are going to be better than this, and they all have been. So,
but here's what I'll also say too. Emily's a wild card. And if Emily had come on for Cruel World and said, like, this movie rips, I wouldn't have been.
Never do that.
But I don't know with you. Sometimes you're a fan of things where I'm just like, sure.
That are bad.
Well, that I don't particularly love. Let's put
that
way. I'm surprised by. You become a stan for things that I'm just like, is this a bit?
It always is until it isn't.
Yeah.
I was a Taylor Swift fan as a bit, and look at me now.
Can I make you a t-shirt that says that?
Yeah. Yeah. I'll wear it to her wedding to Travis.
Oh my God. Okay.
Don't wish such things. Oh, this was great. Libby, you're
Thank
the best.
So much.
We can't wait to have
me.
You back on.
Where can,
yes.
where can people,
that you love.
Where can people find you, Libby? And what would you have anything you want to plug?
Am I supposed to like my address?
Yes.
I don't want them to find
Libby,
me.
You are still on Twitter.
Theoretically.
The X.com platform.
Theoretically.
Right.
A terrible place to be. Don't go there.
Right.
But you're also on Instagram. Right?
Yeah. I mostly post Talk. On my child's account. My
yes,
child's locked
that's fair.
Account.
That's
pictures
fair. That's
of my
fair.
Child. I yeah. am theoretically on Instagram. You can find me on Twitter/X/Instagram mm-hmm. at Midwest Spitfire. Mm-hmm. I might
and
actually
Libby
be
Hill
locked down
in Midwest.
But on Blue
oh.
Sky, I am Libby Hill. I was an early adopter, and I was able to beat the local Carolina
the
chain, Libby Hill Seafood. To the punch. They can eat it.
Well, they can find you there, and then you know, hopefully they'll see your episode someday in the future of television, right?
Maybe.
We can't take any credit for anything on Yellow Jackets the show yet, because nothing we've written has made it to air. We can take credit for the insect, though. We did invent
Ooh.
Yellow Jacket the insect. So.
Yes.
Oh, that's cool. The actual the bee.
Yeah, that was the pitch that we made to God. And God was sounds good.
Yeah. All right, guys. Love you both.
Love
Talk
you.
Soon.
Thanks, Phil.
Bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.